Hey, welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter, and we are joined by somebody who is very much in demand these days. In fact, she has a new title, BFD, Molly Jong Fast. Hey, Molly.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Okay, so we will talk about your new BFD role, particularly at the Daily Beast in a moment, but you know, I started the day realizing that there are 21 days left in this decade.
Yes.
21 days. What the hell happened? Now, here's my one hot take on all of this about this decade, which I don't think has a name. Is there a name for this decade? I mean,
bad.
I mean, we know that
bad decade.
Yeah, the 20s or 30s. I'm down with that. The thing about this last decade is we didn't see it coming. Nobody can say they saw this decade coming, did they?
Right.
I mean, think what you thought the world, what was coming in 2009. So we're sitting around, it's December 11th, 2009. People are saying, okay, well, that decade's gone. I mean, we've been through 9/11. We've been through these wars and everything. What's the next decade going to bring? Nobody would have come up with the right answer. Kind of humbling, isn't it?
It's true. No one saw any of this coming.
And scary. Okay, so let me just go out on a limb here. Are you a fan of the Avengers movies in any way whatsoever?
I mean, I've seen them. I actually didn't see the one from the. I know where you're going with this.
Good,
so
okay.
I haven't seen the one. I was actually wrong on the first when I saw. So this is you're talking about this like incredible self-own that the Trump team
tweet, right? I mean, again, fans of the Avengers are going to get it, but I understand not everybody is. They put out this 21-second video. This comes from the Trump War Room Twitter, featuring this very dramatic scene from the Avengers Endgame movie, in which the supervillain, who's Thanos, is about to carry out his mission of wiping out half of the universe. But they've edited it, and they've superimposed Trump's face on Thanos when the character snaps his fingers, and when he snaps his fingers, you have you know Democratic leader, you know, Schiff, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, they're turned to dust. But here's the deal: it's anybody that's ever seen this movie knows a couple of things. Number one, you know, Thanos is the bad guy. He's the supervillain.
Yeah.
He's a genocidal warlord. He is a mass murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually watch the movie, the scene that Trump's brain trust put together is actually just a couple of seconds before Thanos realizes that the Avengers have outsmarted him. So this really is kind of a epic self-own.
Yes. I mean, I always wonder with that Twitter account that it's clear they don't totally know what they're doing there, and because the Trumpers just love Trump, they almost are sort of, you know, they're like, well, it was meant to be ironic, or it was sarcastic, or we're trolling you. I mean, we're trolling the libs, we're owning the libs is the continual theme of all Trumpism. So you don't even know. I mean, it seems preposterous, but then they're saying, well, we got people talking about how preposterous it is. So we win and we've owned the libs.
Yeah. And that's exactly the thinking. So, okay, we're all, even though I'm not a lib, I'm owned. We talked about it. Let's move on. So let's get right into this, because you have had a series of, you know, rather dramatically high profile interviews, most notably Lisa Page, who is an obsession of the President of the United States, who's talked about her endlessly. In fact, last night in Pennsylvania, he was still talking about Lisa Page. And Lisa Page sat down with you for the very first interview that she's ever given. And it was a rather dramatic moment. So let me ask you the question that
I think it's the only interview she's ever done.
Mm.
Yeah.
So let me ask you the question that everybody in the media was asking. Why you? How did this happen?
So, you know, what's interesting to me is so this is what happened. A friend of mine knew her, and I wrote to him and I said, he's not someone I know particularly well. I met him once. And I said, I see that you know Lisa Page. she should talk to me. And he was like, oh, she's not going to ever do any interviews. She doesn't want to be famous. She just wants to, like, be left alone. And I said, okay, well, just give her my number. And, you know, if she wants to text me, she can text me. And if not, you know, whatever. But I'm happy to talk to her if she wants to talk. So then I assumed I would never hear from her. And, you know, I do this all the, I do this with a lot of times with people. I say, you know, just take my number. If you want to text me, text me. And then I got a text from her and I said, do you want to, you think you want to talk to me? And she said, no. And I said, okay. And then we went back and forth and, you know, it just, I didn't push it. I knew, you know, I knew she had this incredible story to tell about being a mom of young kids who, and I have to say she's a mom of young kids who's a lawyer, who made this mistake, which was the affair, and who then had this mistake weaponized against her for the last 2 years by the most powerful man in the world. So I won't, or, you know, most powerful man in quotes in the world. So I really wanted to know what that is like. And so, what I did was I just said, you know, I think that even though you don't want to be famous, which it's like, it's weird to interview someone who doesn't want to be famous because almost everyone wants to be famous, you know, I said, but even though you don't want to be famous, the fact that he completely controls the narrative about you is problematic for any number of reasons. And like you, it would be very useful for you to correct the record on certain things. And I think that also more than that, there's an opportunity to show people what Trump is doing to the government and its many institutions.
And what the personal cost is as well, because this was a very raw personal story that, you know, I am a human being. I am a mom. I have to go home at night. I have to look people in the eyes on the metro. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the most powerful things. So what was that? The turning point was when the president was doing his fake orgasm with her name.
Yeah. So that rally in Minnesota was the moment she said she just couldn't. She said she realized he wasn't going to leave her alone and that she had to say something. And what I think is so interesting about her, she's like this incredibly, she's completely self-made. She comes from very lower middle class background. She, you know, you don't get to be the only woman in your honors, in your DOJ honors class of five people, unless you are pretty incredible. And so she's like a big brain and very smart and very motivated. So for her to watch the president of the United States fake an orgasm with her name, I think was pretty much, she just decided she had to do something.
So why you?
Yeah. I think that it was two things. One is that I think some of it is just that I reached out to her. So I got in front of her. I mean, that is the thing, you know, what people don't realize so much, I think, is that if you don't get out in front of somebody, they don't know to call you, right? They're not going to call. I mean, who was it? There was some case where the Kavanaugh accuser. She just like called the Washington Post, mm-hmm. right? Like if you don't know people, like most people don't know journalists.
But there had to be, every journalist in America must have known that there was a story there. So other people must have contacted her.
I don't know. I mean, she's not, it was 2 years. She keeps a pretty low profile. And, but it's certainly possible. But she, you know, I said that I thought we should show the human cost of Trumpism. So I think she knew that I was interested in more than just, like, the problem with a story like that and the problem with talking to women who've had this experience, and I had the same uncomfortability talking to Katie Hill, is they have had the worst thing they've ever done weaponized against them by the conservative media. So, but you have to ask them about the worst thing they've ever done, right? Because that is the thing. So you're in this terrible position, or at least I am in this terrible position of sitting next to someone who's had their entire life decimated by this thing that you have to now talk to them about. And so it is, as someone who, like, even though I like to fight with people on Twitter, in the real world, I'm actually pretty non-confrontational. So for me to have to bring up this painful thing with these women who've been through so much is very hard for me. But I also feel like ultimately when you talk about this, when these women talk about their experience with it, it's so helpful because we read so much media where we don't see, and it's not, I don't think it's the journalist's fault at all. I think it's just the way that news is. We don't see, we're sort of not supposed to make it personal. We're not supposed to see the human side.
So you obviously were a sympathetic ear. You could,
yes.
you could empathize with them.
Yeah.
So you're saying that your Twitter persona to one side, you're kind of like the Oprah of the anti-Trump media.
Well, I don't think I would call myself that seems, but I do think.
Hold on. I'm gonna tweet this out now. Molly John Fass is becoming the Oprah of the anti-Trump media.
But I think
it's more viral.
I think this is more that I want to see. I want to be able to see what it is like inside when that happens. And I've had similar experiences where people have gotten very mad at me in the conservative media, as you well know. And so I know what it's like to be very targeted. And so I think in some ways I have to bring that.
Well, see,
my right.
People do not generally know. And this may actually sound like a cliche. I don't know. People actually who have not been the subject of vicious public attacks don't really know what it's like. You know, the inability to go outside and you know, meet people, look people in the eye, to have, you know, to be shamed at this level. I do think that there's a tendency to forget that the people that we're talking about are actually people. Now,
yes.
That doesn't mean that we don't hold people accountable or that we can't be harsh with them, but they are human beings and they have to explain themselves to their husbands, to their mothers, to their father, to their kids, and that this stuff really does play at a completely different level. I think there is this tendency to treat people as if they are sort of impersonal entities. So what was the most you get together with her for lunch, right?
What we did was she just came to my hotel room.
Okay.
So we could just talk, and she came in the morning, and we sat there for like 3 hours.
This is in D.C.?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, sorry, go on.
No. So you sit down, and you talk for 3 hours.
Yeah. I missed a lot of Twitter, but I figured it was
No, okay. You didn't. You missed nothing. Nothing happened in that 3 hours. It was more interesting.
She was ready to talk, and she wanted to set the record straight, and she also just wanted to, you know, she had a lot to say, and I don't know, you know, she's very smart. That's the other thing. It's so she has a lot of thoughts. But what was the most meaningful moment for me? And remember, this is a woman who is like a private person who ended up with death threats and people camped outside her house taking photographs. But the thing that struck me that was the most profound was at the end, she was at the end of the interview, she's weeping about the FBI and how the president has ruined the FBI. Like, that is her concern, because she's saying, you know, Comey's gone, Andy McCabe is gone. She was Andy McCabe's counsel. She was his lawyer. So she was very tight with him. But she, you know, Strzok is gone. Strzok trained like 1,200 FBI agents. Like, everybody knew him. I mean, he was like the guy. So I felt like she is like just weeping about this you know, how he sort of destroyed the FBI. And that was, to me, the most profound moment. I also had this realization, which was that the president doesn't understand these government servants. Like, he doesn't understand why someone would take a job at the DOJ that pays significantly less than a job in the private sector. He doesn't get it, because he's completely motivated by greed. So when he assumes these people are all partisans because that's the only reason he thinks anyone would ever get into the government. But ultimately, and with Strzok and Page, like, they worked on both the Hillary Clinton emails and the Trump Russia, and they both, and they, you know, it was found by the IG that they were actually more aggressive with the Hillary Clinton emails. And she talked to me about when Comey set, when they were working on the Hillary Clinton emails, and she said Comey kept saying, we do this fast, we do this, you know, like, we go in super accurately, we make sure to work incredibly hard, but we get it done before the election to avoid politics. So I just think Trump has no idea what it's like to do something that isn't completely self, that for self.
All right, let's go to the IG report. The IG report that came out this week said, we found that while she attended some of the discussions, Lisa Page did not play a role in the decision to open Crossfire Hurricane, which was the Russia investigation, or the four individual cases. Strzok was directly involved in the decisions to open Crossfire Hurricane and the four individual cases, but we found he was not the sole or even the highest level decision maker as to any of those matters. Then it goes on. So given the fact that, you know, she's not directly involved in this, what happens, of course, is these text messages are released. These romantic text messages with this man who she's having the affair with are released, in which they are expressing their personal opinions about Trump's candidacy, which were, you know, and now we've also seen that there were FBI agents that were pro-Trump. I guess the question is, why has the president been so fixated on her? What was it about her and those text messages, which I think generally people will concede were probably not a good idea, were indiscreet. I'm sure that she would rather not have, you know, engaged in that conduct again. But why Lisa Page? And because, let's face it, she is as well known as any person in this, you know, wild menagerie of characters that are involved in this.
So I think that the reason he got so obsessed with her is twofold. One is that the villains Trump likes to have to have something to pick on. So she has this affair and she has these text messages. So it's not like him go, you know, like, you could see him thinking about going after Yovanovitch, right? You could see that he tweeted about her. But then he realized, like, she's older. She lives in D.C. You know,
he doesn't have a hook. Yeah.
Right. He doesn't have a hook. Like, if Yovanovitch had some affair, he'd be all over that. But so he has this kind of hook for it. And then also, they're obsessed with the idea that this investigation was somehow caused by nefarious FBI agents, which we all know it wasn't. So I think that is part of it too. So he's constantly trying to, like, discredit the FBI, discredit the CIA, discredit the DOJ. So this plays into that because he has this text message that says, you know, he's not going to be president, is he? And so I think that's part of it. What's interesting to me is that, and I don't know how many people know this, this is like a little bit of news-ish, is that they were encouraged to use the government phones because they were secure and the home phones were not secure. Your personal cell phone is not secure. And they didn't want you toggling back and forth and making mistakes. So they were encouraged to use those phones. So even when you get interviewed, and I've been interviewed about this a little bit, people will say, well, they'll take her side and they'll say, but, you know, she shouldn't have used the government phones, because that is ultimately where you would say, like, come on. But they really were told that it's better to use the government phones, that they didn't want you toggling back and forth, that they didn't want you getting confused. And so I do think that is an important thing to know, just because it does change the calculus of it a little bit.
So let's talk about the reaction to the story, because you wrote a follow-up story as well in which you said she was a casualty, not a victim, and you knew this was going to be a big deal when you published the story.
No, we didn't think
it was going to be this big. This is a 3,800-word story. got more than 2 million page views. She was happy with the way she you told the story. And you said, well, this wasn't really a normal interview. It was a genuinely, you wrote, a genuinely endangered woman trusting me with her story. And so you got massive blowback. A lot of it was kind, but give me your what surprised you about the reaction you got? Because I'm guessing you got more reaction to the story than anything you've ever done or written, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, probably. I mean, I like the bad faith criticism the best.
You like it.
Because I love it. I adore it. You know, when they were talking about me on Fox and Friends, I was like, oh, I'm going to get a tweet. I was a little disappointed they didn't mention me by name. I mean, and Tucker has always had a thing where he doesn't like me. And Sean Hannity was furious. And I felt like the getting in the head of those Fox opinion hosts is means we did something right.
Okay, so Brian Kilmeade was troubled.
Yes.
He wanted to know why you didn't ask Paige, where is this professor that started the whole thing? Where's the ambassador
right.
that meets him by chance in a bar? This goes back into it, and there's no follow-up questions from the Daily Beast reporter, you. I'll tell
yeah.
you, and so why? Why didn't you ask her those things?
About Crossfire Hurricane?
Yeah.
And because it's ridiculous. First of all, she was the lawyer to Andy McCabe. She didn't even, I mean, she wasn't even involved in this. She saw maybe... So, I mean, she did. First of all, I'm not going to ask her classified information because that is not, you know, she's not going to tell me classified information. I mean, that's the thing with interviewing these FBI people is as much as Trump loves to disparage them, they are very, very careful and will not tell you anything that is FBI that even is still classified at all or even what, you know, even sort of things that maybe aren't classified now. They're so careful. So that was the other thing. But I'm not going to ask her conspiracy theories that I know aren't true. I mean, that's for Fox News.
So, you know? So there was this huge blowback. The president obviously is not dissuaded. Last night he was in Pennsylvania and he's making up a story about her having some sort of a restraining order.
Which is not true.
He just makes the shit up now.
Yeah.
But she is pushing back. She's filed a lawsuit against the FBI. What is that about?
So they did leak her text messages and. It was widely reported by Natasha Bertrand and by Politico, by this one, by that one, that they called the night before Ron Rosenstein went to testify on the Hill. And the day after Mike Flynn pled guilty, they released a group of text messages to the press. And they said that they couldn't source the DOJ. They had some Hill reporters come
really?
And look at them, but they said they couldn't source the DOJ. So now that happens to be that Lisa Page is a lawyer. So she was like, you know, that is not, it's not legal. So I don't know. She's going, I'm not a lawyer. But that was what happened. And it has been widely reported. People were extremely mad at me for writing that, though it's been reported in different places. But she was, I mean, those were the text messages that destroyed her life. So I could see where she'd have some hostility towards it.
Yeah, and obviously there's some issues involving privacy there. Okay, so yeah. you've had a more recent interview with former Congresswoman Katie Hill, who is probably the most famous casualty of revenge porn. And I have questions. About that.
Yes.
And let's talk about that right after this. Let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Hiring is challenging, and it used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter. In fact, go to ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you cannot miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. Right now, listeners here can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/begin. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEGIN. ZipRecruiter.com/begin. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, we are back with Molly Jong Fast, who has a new title at the Daily Beast, BFD. No, you're actually an editor at large. So I'm an editor at large too. So what do you get, like a large? What is the at large? You get a like big, really big office.
Oh yeah, big office, lots of money. I take a helicopter. I'm also still a contributor at the at the Bulwark.
Yeah, but we need to make you like contributor at large.
Yes, I need a fancy title.
They at large. I had John Harwood on. He's editor at large. Love I'm editor. That. So we got to have this thing. It's like we are at large. I don't know what it means.
Exactly.
I feel like it's kind of like buffaloes roaming along the plains, the prairies, like whatever, wherever the wind blows us. Okay, so Katie Hill. This is an interesting story to me, and I think there's a generational issue. And so let's go right to the generational issue.
Okay.
What is with people taking nude pictures of themselves?
I mean, I'm a little old for the. This is not my generation. This is like the generation after mine. It's a thing. I mean, they do it. I think it's happening. It happens more than you'd think. I mean, it seems like a potential mistake.
Potential mistake. Yeah. Seems like a potential mistake.
It seems like it could be problematic in the future. It would not be my first choice. I don't know. It's hard to know. Well,
Nancy Pelosi got dragged a little bit because she said, hey, we have to tell the people, you know, young people, don't do this anymore because bad things will happen. And people are going, okay, boomer to her about all of this. But that actually seemed to kind of make sense. But then again, I actually am a boomer. So this is another story of a woman who was destroyed through malice. And there seems to be several layers of this. Number one, she left her husband. And apparently she married him when she was 16. Did I read that correctly?
Yeah. I don't know if she married him, she got together with
him. So this was a bad relationship, and she decided she was going to end it. He threatened to destroy her. He apparently now denies that he leaked the pictures, but whatever.
And says he was hacked.
Yeah, he was hacked, which people need to come up with like a better thing for that because, you know, they right, you were hacked.
Right. Like
Ted Cruz was hacked when he
when he liked like, that.
yeah. That was he was hacked. But apparently that's what everybody does here. But you tell the story though, and she's written a piece in the New York Times where she describes this, you know, her communications director coming into her office and telling her that she knew that there were these nude photos floating around, telling her that they were online, that they had been published. A conservative site, Red State, which has basically become kind of a, you know, Trumpist propaganda arm. And later the Daily Mail publishes all of these pictures. And, you know, you want to talk about the shock of being completely, quote unquote, exposed there.
Yeah.
And she probably realized at that point her political career was, if not over, was going to be severely impacted.
Yeah, I think she, what I was the most surprised about there was that I asked her if she regretted, because a lot of people have come to me or when you talk about it casually, they say, oh, she never should have, she never should have resigned. She should have stayed, on and she shouldn't have, you know, given up her seat. And it's, and she was very much like, I'm glad I resigned. It was time. I didn't want to be a distraction. She was very selfless when she talked about it, I thought. And,
but why did she resign? Particularly when it was almost like she resigned and people went, wait, what is that about? You were the victim of revenge porn here. The misconduct she was accused of. Now, she clearly had a relationship with a campaign
staffer.
Which, okay, you know, personal choice. But she was accused, the substantive accusation was that she also had a relationship with a member of her congressional staff, which would have been clearly in violation of the rules. But she denies that, right?
Yeah.
So she says the one thing that actually would have gotten her in trouble as a congressperson, she says, did not happen.
I think that she just felt like she was too distracting, and that she didn't want to hurt a lot of the members of the freshman class, which I think is pretty noble. I also think that she was in an impossible situation, and she knew that this ex would not stop. I think that she would she hoped that if she stepped down, he would stop. I think that was the other thing. I think she felt like she didn't know where it would go or what he would keep doing. And I think she's pretty traumatized. I mean, it's a really, her op-ed, she talked about trying to kill herself. It's horrible. I think it's a pretty traumatic experience. I also think that it's, you know, this targeting, I mean, what I thought was interesting about, and I didn't write about it enough, is the way that the conservative media shopped this was it started out, red state started out as like, in this way that it was a truple. It was like the three of them were together and these attractive lesbian women in Congress. You know, it was set up in a very salacious way to sell sex. And a very smart friend of mine who's a journalist wrote to me and was like, oh my God, this story with the truple. Have you ever heard of a truple? And that is not the story. Like, the story is this woman who had this bad marriage that got very complicated, that, and he decided, she tried to get out of it. Look, did she have culpability here? Oh, no question. I mean, you know, there were a number of stuff that she did that he, you know, was problematic at best. But the story is not like a salacious sex story about, you know, it was sort of shopped like
it was a threesome though, right?
Right.
Okay. I mean, but she didn't make any secret of that. I mean, wasn't it known that, I mean, didn't she run as bisexual?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, okay. So that was, she didn't run as a member of the Christian right. I mean, she didn't run. So let's face it. It's a little bit salacious.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it is salacious, but I also think it was shopped in a way that was to sell the sex. I don't know. The whole thing was very problematic to me.
Well, here's the interesting thing about it is, because I remember this in real time, because Red State is, quite frankly, I think, kind of a sketchy site. And the person that posted this is somebody that actually had worked for the congressman that she ousted during the election and is now, I mean, is an activist. This is not really a journalist. So when the pictures were posted, I remember there was a pause and wondering, will the rest of the media pick it up? And I think the initial reaction in people in journalism was, we're not going there. We're just not going there. This is not appropriate. This is a personal life, naked pictures. We're just not doing it. So there was a, I don't know how long it was. Was it 36 hours, 48 hours, whatever? And then sort of the dam broke. And this was another one of those moments where, you know, the journalistic ethics had to adapt themselves to both the new technology and to the new sort of circumstances of you know, what's fair game and what's not fair game. So, you know, should they have published it in the first place? I don't know. I'm trying to think that, you know, if somebody came to the Bulwark and said, we have naked pictures of blank, 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 we would go, we're not in that business. But you know that there's somebody who is in that business, and between Red State and Daily Mail, it was all out there.
Well, Daily Mail is really, really problematic, and also we know that they, I mean, I don't know if this is known or not, but there's often a financial incentive with the Daily Mail. So I don't, you know, I think that she kept saying to me, I thought I was I knew there were pictures, but I didn't think anyone would publish them.
Yeah.
That's what she kept saying. And, or she said she didn't know there were, she knew, she's, a lot of the pictures she said she didn't know about, but she said she suspected when he was saying that, that there were pictures and that, that she, but that no one would ever publish them because it's just so inappropriate. And, I would have been worried. I would have thought that they would have published them.
Okay,
like,
so
because the Daily Mail.
Yeah, and again, yeah. This, we go back to some of the things we were talking about with Lisa Page, and of course, I cannot identify, and I'm not claiming I can't identify, but if I had naked pictures of me, which do not exist, out there in the world, I don't think I'd ever be able to leave the house again. I do. It would be so horrific. But let's go back to her decision to resign. Because, you know, there are a lot of people who are saying that was not necessary. And, of course, you point out that, you know, she knew there was other stuff. It was like having a loaded gun aimed at her. And this obviously, this vindictive, vicious ex-husband was capable of doing a lot of things. But if she would have sat down with, say, Ralph Northam, the governor of Virginia,
right. I'm like, right.
let's talk about this. You know, if I just survive this period, can I actually stay in office? Or here's one for you, Jeff Bezos. Do you remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
And he just went, he confessed it, did it. And when's the last time you even heard about that?
I mean, Jeff Bezos is a billionaire.
Yeah.
yes, it's true. There have been a lot of men who've written out scandal. We don't live in a world where men and women are held to the same standards, even a little. And especially now that the that we live in Trump world where women are in fact, even more.
Well, Al Franken.
Right.
Play the Al Franken card on you.
Okay,
I do wonder. Well, a lot of people wonder about why did you resign? There is sort of an asymmetry of people who are utterly and completely without shame. Who will just either flat out deny or brazen it out. And then there are the folks who, you know, the bad story comes, there's, you know, it blows up, and then they're gone. Al Franken, Katie Hill.
I think Northam would have resigned had the Democrats been able to find someone lower down in the chain.
That's exactly right, by the way.
but since it turned out that everybody had a problem, they just let him stay. So, I mean, I think largely Democrats try, and I think often to their detriment, to do the right thing and that they believe, and I think this is incredibly problematic for Democrats and just in general, that because they're the good guys, they should do the right thing and they should win, which as you and I know, doesn't happen necessarily. But
I remember when Republicans thought they were the good guys. Conservatives, we are the good guys. So,
yeah, well. You got to get Trump is probably not so good for that.
No, not so good. So how do you think the Democrats are doing on impeachment?
You know, this is this thing where it's like Kavanaugh. When Kavanaugh came out, everyone was like, oh, the Democrats have blown it. Kavanaugh got put in, he has this lifetime appointment, the Democrats are being ridiculous, but ultimately Democrats won the midterms, but they couldn't have won the Senate. I mean, the Senate map's insane, and also I don't know that those seats, what seats are we talking about? We're talking about what's her name,
well, Missouri.
Yeah, and Claire McCaskill, and who else?
North Dakota, Indiana, and Florida.
Right. I mean, I think there were some extenuating circumstances in Florida for sure.
Okay. But impeachment,
but yeah, but I mean, right. So. But the Democrats won a lot of like swing districts and a lot of House seats that were thought to be unwinnable. I mean, I just think it's early days to say if it's going to work or not. Look, is he going to be impeached? Yes. Is he going to be removed? No. I think it's very unlikely. But We can't think that it's okay to keep asking foreign countries.
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm just talking tactically. I mean, I'm looking at your colleague and our mutual friend Rick Wilson, who has this piece in the Daily Beast saying the Democrats are blowing it because they're kind of rushing through it. They want to get back to the business of stuff, and I think he was obviously not impressed by yesterday's press conference where they announced that, yes, we're going to impeach him. And then 5 minutes later, and we're going to give him his biggest legislative win of his term by passing the new NAFTA piece of legislation. And apparently it does seem that we're going to do the impeachment and then we're going to move on to doing deals. So
I agree. I think he's totally right. And actually, I read that piece early on and suggested that he talk about that. Just full disclosure. But I did think that he should, that Democrats should Benghazi this, like just make it a spectacle and drag it out for as long as possible. And I don't think there's any reason to kick it to the Senate. And I mean, I say keep it as long as you possibly can. The idea if Mitch isn't taking up the bills, Democrats have passed 400 bills that Mitch McConnell has not had any interest in looking at. So if he's not passing bills, then why pass this on to him? Just keep it, keep going, have trials endlessly, have testimonies, have this, have that. I mean, I don't think there's any incentive.
I agree with you, and I guess I have written this and gotten significant blowback on it as well. The rush feels more panicky than confident. I mean, I do think they have enough evidence. I know, but have they effectively weaponized that evidence? Have they waited to let the public catch up? I mean, the fact is that the average voter does not follow this as closely as the average viewer of cable television. And
right.
And you need sometimes to, repeat it, find ways to amplify it. It seems that there's this effort. We're going to do it, but we're going to do it in such a, abbreviated, quick way that we can move on. Doesn't strike. It seems like they're allowing their anxieties that this is going to backfire in their face get ahead of, hey, this is a big deal and this is a national emergency. Because if this really does pose an existential threat to our democracy, you don't turn around 5 minutes later and do business with the guy, do you?
I agree. And I see no, I mean, I think you make this just as much of a spectacle as possible. You do what the Republicans did with Benghazi and with other things like that. I completely agree. But I don't know, let's see what happens. We've still got a lot of time. I do think Democrats have been, we're living in this weird world where they're reading our writing. I mean, you saw that the other day when, political pundits were the people who told Nancy Pelosi finally that she had to impeach him. Because, right? Remember, she was like, I'm not going to do it. And pundits were like, you have to do this. So I do think there's a receptivity that we've never seen before with politicians, for good or for bad. I'm not sure, but I think it's too soon to know. But I do think that pundits have more power than they've ever had. So let's see what happens.
Well, I'm not going to be one of them, but I did have a piece in the Bulwark today. Two cheers for the articles of impeachment, and I do think that they were concise, and I think that they were comprehensive. So I don't think that they blew it necessarily on that. But on the other hand, there is this kind of the sense that we've all fallen victim to this fundamental phenomenon in the Trump era, which there's so many scandals, there's so many abuses that it's hard to keep up or keep track, much less hold him accountable for what he's doing, and drawing a distinction between what's just annoying and what's truly dangerous. So you start going through the list of things that they ought to have included, and it's pretty long, including the obstruction of Congress. I think is legitimate, but does it go far enough? Does it? I think our friends at Lawfare point out that it kind of ignores the broader assertions outside the context of impeachment of this absolute immunity, and that really fails to capture how Trump's action represents an outright assault on the very notion of congressional oversight. So there's a constitutional crisis there, not to mention the voluminous evidence of obstruction of justice that was in the Mueller report. So, yeah, the two articles of impeachment are great, but the analogy I use, it's like an amputated limb that you sort of really still feel the absence of that third or fourth article that would deal with his abuses of American law enforcement, his other challenges to the Constitution. But apparently that's what we get.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an impossible situation. They can't, if they do what some people want them to do, they won't do what other people. I've heard really convincing arguments for making it narrow. I've heard really convincing arguments for making it broad. The thing that I think is the most interesting is that Republicans have decided that the way to defend Trump is to say that Democrats are just always after him for something. But they leave out the fact that he keeps doing these things, and that's why they're always after him. You know, so I think that is a fascinating trope. His need to crime is insatiable. And so I think that if Democrats don't at least try to say you can't crime, they are woefully.
Is this the thing now? Is it Molly John? Are you turning the word crime into a verb?
It is.
This is your contribution now that you are fighting to make crime into a verb.
Yes.
And criming as well.
To crime. Yes. I think that it's probably, I hope that is my,
This could be your legacy.
Exactly.
Okay, so in the few minutes we have left, apparently there's this political report that says that Joe Biden is telling people that he would only serve one term. Thoughts?
I saw that this morning. Look, it's the kind of thing that I love that idea of because he's so old, but it's a question of the larger question is, can you run for office on the idea that you won't be there that long? I don't know.
I think what it does is it basically says, let me be the interim placeholder, and whoever I pick as vice president, that's the real deal. I mean, it puts so much weight then on his vice presidential choice because he's basically saying, look, I'm going to break the fever, and in terms of what the future of the party is, this person. So yeah. I don't know how that's going to play out. But again, it is. I'll be interesting to hear what the reaction is. My initial reaction was I sort of assumed that to begin with, he'd be 80. He's going to be 82 years old in 4 years. So, then, of course, then the question is who could he possibly choose? And Stacey Abrams is putting herself in that ring. Interesting. Yeah. Kamala Harris bows out. Stacey Abrams holds up her hand. She still hasn't conceded that she lost in Georgia, though. So
did Kamala Harris say she wouldn't be the?
No. She dropped out of the presidential race. I didn't mean that.
Yeah,
she'll take it. Absolutely. I mean, has anybody anywhere ever said they won't take the vice presidential nomination? Seriously?
It's true. I have to say, I may get blowback for this, but I really she's really smart and competent. And there is something to be said for smart and competent.
Who?
Kamala.
Okay.
Kamala Harris. There is something to be said for smart and competent women. And I am a big fan of smart and competent women, though, is all I will say.
Yeah. Well, see, this is the thing about Joe Biden. If Joe Biden is running and it's one term and he picks, it's hard for me to imagine him not picking a woman. I could certainly see all sorts of different combinations that change the entire dynamic of the race.
Oh, yeah.
This new poll out, I think it's the Quinnipiac poll, showing every Democrat beating Trump. What was really striking to me was that in every matchup, Donald Trump gets only 42 or 43%. That's what he gets. That is where he is stuck, And so, he's not moving.
It's interesting because David Frum was talking to me about this idea that he always is at 42%. Like the day he had his inauguration speech, like the biggest bump he got was like 43%. He never goes above his base, and that more than 50% of the population just despises the man. So I don't know where that leaves us. Look, there's no precedent for Trumpism. There's no precedent for his reelection campaign. We are like in this world that does not exist. We're in the Matrix. But I do think I could see a world where he loses really badly. That would be my fantasy too.
Yeah, I keep coming back to those swing states where he's much more competitive. But you know, in terms of we've never seen this before. We've never seen a president with an economy this strong, with this many people thinking the country is economically going in the right direction, trailing this badly. I think it was Aaron Blake from the Washington Post said, you know, if it wasn't for Trump himself, it would be inconceivable to imagine the president under these circumstances not winning re-election. If you had just some generic other Republican there, he'd be fine. But exactly. Donald Trump is this unique black swan event, and we'll see what happens here. So anyway, congratulations on these interviews. And I'm guessing that these will not be the last since you've established your brand. So
well, I hope that people will still talk to me. It's so stressful. It honestly makes me, I have to tell you, there is literally nothing more stressful than these interviews.
Why do you say that?
Because first of all, it's usually someone who has some horrible thing happen to them, you're not a publicist. You want to really tell their story. So you have to ask them these horrible questions. And so I hate that.
The stakes are so high
and the people are so upset and it's just awful. And then sometimes people get mad at you for things you couldn't even possibly see coming in a million miles away. I mean, the whole thing is just a virtual landmine of problems and issues. It's problematic, but it's also, strange and
you don't want to re-victimize them and you know that you're going to get a ton of murder dropped on your head no matter what you do. So
exactly. And that's the other thing, is you don't want to re-victimize them you also want to tell their story in an honest way, and you don't, you know, you're not a publicist, so it's a really tough it's a tough road to walk.
All right. So Molly Jong-Fast, thank you so much for spending time with us here on The Bulwark. Molly Jong-Fast is an editor-at-large of The Daily Beast and a contributor to The Bulwark. So good talking with you again, Molly.
Thank you for having me, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.